You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to another edition of Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent, Editor-in-Chief. I'm here with...
Susie Evans, I'm a Senior Editor.
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And we've got such a show for you today. We're going to start off with a little talk about our February issue, which is already out on newsstands and a lot of the stories online, with the theme of theater and television. We're also going to talk about what seems to be a sea change of transitions in Chicago. It hasn't really crept up on us, but we just sort of noticed a bunch. And then a little news gossip. And then our main feature this week is an exciting interview. It's not an interview with Eric Bogosian and Mike Daisy. It's an interview between them. They talk to each other about solo shows, why they hate them, why they love them, why they did them or do them. And it's a great conversation. I hope you stick around for that. So let's kick off with a little talk about our TV issue with one of our most beautiful covers ever. Deep, yay. Who do we talk to?
We talked to Danai Gurira, the playwright of Broadway-bound play Eclipsed and also Familiar, which is opening at Playwrights Horizons next month. And if you're a zombie fan, she is one of the best characters on AMC's The Walking Dead, which is, it used to be the highest rated show on cable. I think it's down to number two or three now, but still pretty good.
It's very popular. I feel like the Venn diagram of people who know her from Walking Dead and know that she's this hot playwright is not big enough. And I want to expand that. I had this idea that we would, there's of course the story about playwrights writing for TV is not a new one.
Of course not.
But it does seem to be more entrenched than ever. And there's a trend of showrunners, the people who actually create the shows, coming from TV. And so we have a big story about that. And I just
coming from theater.
Coming from theater. Did I say that?
You said coming from TV.
Coming from TV. Well, also, yeah.
Sometimes the actors come from TV and
right.
do theater.
And like, no, we're talking about the showrunners of shows.
Danai doesn't happen to be a writer for TV.
Oh, she has.
She's working on it.
She's working on an HBO pilot.
Who isn't?
really?
And so, yeah. No, it's an interesting and exciting topic. And, it's again, American Theater has written about it a number of times. I remember a piece we did many years ago, which Adam Rapp and Gina Gianfrido were talking mm-hmm. about. What they learn from TV writing, which is a radical idea, but there's clearly it's not just an exodus story; it's a back and forth story to some extent, even though the money's way out of scale. But there's those two main stories: big feature on Danai and her work as a actor and playwright, but mostly about her playwriting.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
I mean, yeah. It's not in the story, but after the story came out, she just got cast to play Tupac's mother in the new Tupac biopic.
Oh, yeah. I added into the online version because that news came out after
we... I did not.
Big deal. Big movie. Big blockbuster movie.
Okay.
Definitely. I mean, Jay Holtham wrote the showrunners as playwrights as showrunners
right.
story. And what I really loved about that piece, actually, he interviewed Sarah Treem and Sheila Callahan and Rollin Jones. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about that story was when you think of playwrights writing for TV, you think of them being told what to write by a producer and having to compromise on their artistic integrity, so to speak.
Right.
And just doing it for the money. But right. really, they're not doing it for the money. And they actually get a lot of creative satisfaction from running shows and being the one like calling the shots on character arcs and right. being able to develop these big long range stories over 12 episodes.
Mm. Yeah, well, part of that is also the new platforms for TV with online with Netflix. When we talked to Marco Ramirez of who writes for Daredevil, the Marvel show, which is on Netflix, and Amazon Prime and has all those new shows, and then Sarah's is on cable, which is not really new that cable is good TV anymore, but these are different. There's a little looser reins than on something like broadcast TV.
You don't have to sell ads.
Yeah.
For a lot of those. That's one of the things.
And less producer manipulation, so to speak.
I mean, I think they still have to deal with the industry.
Of course, its
biases, but there do seem to be more outlets. And, it does, the cliches are, film is a director's medium. And the cliche has always been that TV was a writer's medium. And what that meant was not necessarily that the writer had always had final say, but the writers were the producers. they're often writers' rooms where they were write by committee, and there's certainly some mandates that come down. But it seems clear that there are a lot of the creative forces that we know that are household names now. Matthew Weiner.
Mm-hmm. Aaron Sorkin.
Right. Those names, whether they started in plays or not, they're sort of the brands of those shows. So the fact that there's a number of them, Sarah Treem on The Affair, Bo Willem on House of Cards.
Liz Merriweather on New Girl.
Although who knows if she's coming back to theater.
We don't know if she's coming back to theater, but she did start in theater.
She did start in theater.
And she is the brand of New Girl. Like she's
right. So we noted that trend with, I would say, you know, interest, approval maybe is too strong, but you know.
What I really actually love about television right now, and Danai and I were talking about it during lunch and I couldn't include that in the article I wrote, is how it's so much more diverse than film now, because you have the backlash against the Oscars being so white because right. they, you know, they idolize like films with white characters in them. But television, there's a melee of voices mm-hmm. and people being represented and people writing for them. And the biggest shows on television right now are Shonda Rhimes' shows, which mm-hmm. are usually headlined by a woman of color.
Right.
And so it begs a question of what's the excuse when it comes to whose stories we choose to prioritize in certain mediums.
Well, I just thought of this right now and I could be totally wrong, but I think with the film, that's independent film is a lot more diverse than studio films. Studio films. And that's also like the distribution method of films. Like if something's a big studio film, it has to get into the big theaters, which is increasingly becoming like an archaic method of distribution. Mm. TV can get on YouTube and you have a series. So it's a little bit easier to mass produce, which is great, which lends itself to, you know, people can take bigger risks with TV, I feel like.
Well, I think part of it's volume too. There's just far mm-hmm. fewer films made every year than there used to be. It's a narrower field.
And I feel like TV is adapting to the changing times of technology a little bit better than film right. is.
I mean, for a long time, when people would complain about not strong roles for women in women's stories, they would often point to TV as the exception. So TV has seemed to fill the role of being in our living rooms and being more reflective of what our lives are like than the sort of – I mean, the rap on films is that they're these thrill rides that we go to. The only thing that gets us out of the house are like, you know – giant blockbusters.
Well, I think the thing is also like people are now pointing in terms of writers, in terms of the gender parity discussion in theater. They're pointing to TV as like, oh, TV's doing mm-hmm. gender parity, right? But theater's not. And like, how is TV adapting faster than we are?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the thing that you didn't mention, Deep, was that not only do writers sometimes talk about the creative satisfaction they have with film, TV, that they sometimes feel they have more creative freedom than they do in theater. I mean, it's six of one, half dozen the other. It's different kinds of control and freedom. They feel constricted by the budgets in theater.
Oh, yes.
And by the rewards of it. And, you know, there also are expectations of audiences and artistic directors. There are gatekeepers there, too. It's not like they just can do whatever the hell they want on the stage any more than they can just go in and do whatever they want on TV. But there's different kinds of creative satisfaction they get from each. I mean, Sarah Treem definitely talks about how theater is a very personal medium, and she writes about things she wouldn't write about on The Affair. And she writes a play every summer. So she's keeping a big part of her creative life still in the theater.
And her plays still get produced, too. Yeah. I mean, one was just at MTC like a year ago, maybe 2 years ago.
Exciting times.
A lot of things to watch.
And we'll maybe talk about some of them later. We noticed today, when we just got the news, that Heidi Stillman was elected. She wasn't appointed. She was elected the new artistic director of Looking Glass Theater in Chicago. Who was the artistic director previous to her?
Andy White. I mean, Looking Glass has a really interesting model, which is sort of similar to Steppenwolf. Mm-hmm. And Rob was going to say that we noticed today that with Heidi Stillman's announcement, there's been a lot of leadership transitions in Chicago. We did a big story a few months ago about all the leadership transitions happening in Minneapolis, but with Heidi, we've kind of noticed a mini trend. So Heidi Stillman has been announced as the new artistic director of Looking Glass. And the way Looking Glass works is they're an ensemble-based theater of writers, directors, actors, and the artistic director always has to come from within the ensemble. And so the previous artistic director was Andy White, who's a founding ensemble member. I think it was founded by David Schwimmer, Andy White, David Catlin, and oh my gosh, I'm going to forget his name. He runs the Actors Gymnasium up in Evanston. Larry DeSasi.
Wow.
The four of them founded it. And so Andy has been serving as artistic director for 6 years, since 2010. And the way Looking Glass works is they vote, the whole ensemble votes on a new artistic director every 3 years. So the goal is kind of like presidents to turn it over. Hmm. And so it looks like Andy got voted in twice, 2-3 years in a row. So he had 2 terms. And so now he's stepping down. It doesn't mean he's leaving the company. He's still in the ensemble. He's going to have a new position of director of connectivity, like something like that.
All right.
It's a new position they created. And Heidi is going to take over the role. She also served as artistic director. They kind of switch off, so you can get the role again. It kind of rotates.
Oh, I see.
So she had it from 97 to 2000. She's been, since 2004, the artistic director of New Work, specifically. It's very active ensemble, and Looking Glass is very cool. But this noted that there's been 3 pretty major transitions at Chicago theater companies. We've talked on this podcast before about how Anna D. Shapiro just became the artistic director of Steppenwolf Theater Company. I actually think, I don't know if I'm totally right about this, I think she was supposed to take over next season, but since Martha had a stroke and her health, she's now stepped in the position this season. I might be wrong about that, but, so she took over from Martha Levy, wonderful artistic director of Steppenwolf for 20 years, who stepped down. And then there's also Bonnie Metzger, who's the new artistic director of American Theater Company, which is, you know, P.J. Paparelli, who passed away in a car accident.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, like, oh, it's a generational change, and it certainly is, but that's not really the case here.
No.
It's definitely not the case at Looking Glass. It's a case at Steppenwolf.
Steppenwolf is a generational change. I don't think it's the case for Looking Glass.
And the case of American Theater Company is just a tragic accident.
It's a tragic accident,
PJ was not even, was he 30?
He was just 40. I think he 40. Just turned
okay.
40.
He died in a car accident in I think, Scotland. Or
yeah, he was on vacation.
Ireland. He was on vacation.
And, I mean, that theater company has been rising. I mean, The Humans started there, which isn't just starting performance
Disgrace
on Broadway.
Started
Disgrace started there.
Yeah.
The Projects, it was a hugely lauded success there. Columbinus, PJ worked on that with Stephen Karam, who wrote The Humans. So there's these 3 major, and I think it's interesting to note that all of the new leadership at these theaters is female, which is exciting.
That's another interesting.
I mean, Martha is great, and it's a great trend. So we're going to be looking into this trend in Chicago, and there might be a piece in the next few weeks about it.
I think one thing you might be able to say is that even though the reasons for the change couldn't be seen as generational in all these cases, the fact that there are qualified and admired and honored female directors who could take the place at this, you know, does seem like a generational.
It does. I mean, I don't think
it's like it's
when
time,
Martha took over Steppenwolf 20 years ago, if this, you know, it was like, look, there's Martha. And I mean, Martha's not a director. Martha's an actor, but she was an artistic director because Steppenwolf's an actor's ensemble. Looking Glass is a little bit different. It's got a little bit more different roles in the ensemble. Steppenwolf does too, but they function slightly differently. Anyway, so there's a bit of a changing of the guard and some really cool female leaders stepping up in the Midwest.
Fascinating. Our last bit of pre-interview talk is a little kerfuffle that's happened. The Wooster Group seems to wander into kerfuffles with every show. This one,
yes.
Why don't you tell us, there's a show called, is it The Room? It's a Pinter play?
Yes, The Pinter play.
Not the movie The Room.
Rob, you hate the.
No, but there is a movie called The Room, and it's supposed to be the worst movie ever made.
Oh, it's that cult favorite, like, horror thing.
Yes, and so, if Wooster Group wanted to redo The Room, be amazing.
When I was backstage, we had one of the actors in that movie write us a piece about being in a cult favorite movie. It was so great.
So this is also like that film. It's happening in Los Angeles first. I was intrigued when I heard about this. This has been announced for a while.
Yeah,
they're
going
to work on a Pinter play.
Yeah, well, they did a tryout. They did a couple of shows here. I think it was at the Kitchen in Chelsea last year. And it's an adaptation of a Pinter play. Wooster Group is the they do riff-offs on classics or riffs on classics. Like last play they did was a Troilus and Cressida adaptation called Cry Trojans.
Mm-hmm. They do original works too, but go on.
Yeah.
And some of the adaptations might as well just be original. They do so much to them. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. And it's kind of murky. Sam French withheld the rights to it. So they're performing it in Los Angeles right now, and they were supposed to perform it again in New York and Paris. But since Sam French sent a cease and desist letter, so to speak, they will not be performing the show at those locations.
Well, here, Sam French is representing the Pinter State. Sam French is not the the boogeyman here. It's they're saying that the Pinterest state, they're saying on behalf of the Pinterest state that Wooster Group didn't get the rights.
Yes.
And that, so they have this weird thing where they're saying you can't promote or...
or invite press to review.
Right. Because people are pointing out like, well, Charlie McNulty can just buy a ticket.
Yeah, like in Spider-Man happened, I just wonder what the sense is in telling press they can't go write about a show, because anyone can come in off the street, buy a ticket, and write anything they want, because now we have Yelp and Twitter.
Well, they could.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the Spider-Man is a very special case where it's a giant Broadway show that was going to invite press at some point anyway. There are cases like this. Where rights are given in a restricted sense. Like, I mean, I've just been aware of them over the years. There was a production of, what's the Kenneth Lonergan play? This Is Our Youth.
Yeah.
It's been performed in Los Angeles, but it has never been performed with critics allowed, right? There's been like showcase productions. So
it's not like a Beckett thing too?
It's not unheard of. No, Beckett's estate has some stringent requirements about casting.
Okay.
But, and they don't let the show go on at all. But there are these Twilight cases where the licensor, whether it's Samuel French or someone else, will say they won't shut down the production, but they don't allow press. Now, again, as you say, press, there's nothing to stop press from buying tickets, as I did for Mother Courage. I mean, I wasn't invited to those previews with Tanya Pink because I just bought a ticket myself.
Well, you didn't review it though.
And I was scrupulous about not reviewing it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I forwarded Rob this email from the publicist for last night. I don't know very much about the situation. And it basically says, press can't review. Don't worry. We're still going to invite press to attend. I'm like,
yeah.
Okay.
I got that invitation too. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It's like, I forwarded it to you. You can still come see the show. LA is the only city that's going to get to see it. Exclusive. And I'm like,
so that's what I see. Voice I hadn't heard from was the Wooster Group. So I guess.
Okay. No, this is from the publicist.
For the Wooster Group. All right. Well,
the weird thing is, because they've already done the show. So I wasn't. What's murky to me is, did they only get the rights to do it in New York? And there's other productions worldwide that the Pinterest state doesn't want to interfere with the Wooster Group production? Or
is it because
they never got the rights in the first place? That was the murkiest part for me.
It seems strange. It's a departure for the Wooster Group to do a play that's not public domain, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think when they did O'Neill.
They did O'Neill?
They did Harry Ape some years ago, like 20 years ago, practically. They've done, you know, they've been all over the map. I just don't know. I don't know enough to know what happened here.
Well, no one does.
And whether they got the rights, but not the right rights. Like, not all the rights, not the rights to perform it publicly for review, because you can get other kinds of rights. Or they.
Yeah, or like rights to modify it, because they tend to do that.
That might also be the, again, we're all speculating here, but it might be that the Pinterest state got wind of what they're doing to the show. And thought, no, you can't put video in this. You can't. I'm not sure. You take off the pause.
We're guessing here.
Right. Yeah, because we haven't reached out to them.
We haven't seen it.
Should we do something?
No, we're talking about whether we can. What we need is someone in Los Angeles who knows the Wooster Group really well, which is a small Venn diagram. So, I mean, they performed a fair amount there, and there are a lot of people
Red
seen
Cats.
Their work.
Yeah, they did. I mean, Cry Trojans went to Red Cats before it went to
Red
New York.
Cat.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's right. And then the Birdie was at UCLA many years ago. They've performed in LA a number of times. We'll report more before we say anything more bad about all the players involved. So I think we can head into our exciting interview.
Conversation,
right. Well, it's a sort of mutual interview between the two of them. The occasion for this was Eric has a book that TCG published a couple of years ago called 100 Monologues. And he has a website now, 100monologues.com, in which he's asked various actors and performers to do his monologues. And he had a number of shows he did many years ago that were monologue based shows. And this is an anthology of excerpted monologues from them that actors can do. Fascinating stuff in there. And so one of the people who did one of the monologues for his website was Mike Daisy, who's a monologuist in his own right. You might have heard of him, the agony and ecstasy of Steve Jobs. Also the How Theater Failed America, another popular one with TCG audiences and theaters. Anyway, we just thought it made sense to put the two of them together because they know each other. They know each other's work. They're mutual fans. And, I don't know much more about the setup. They were talking about theater, and then Eric,
started talking about Hitler.
As you do. So enjoy this conversation.
You know, Adolf Hitler, I don't know if you know this or not, but the whole deal with Adolf Hitler was he was a great performer when he started in the 1920s, and the party, which had grown out of the Freikorps and all those guys in crazy Berlin of the 1920s, there was this guy that every time you brought him out and he started screaming and yelling, the crowds would be massive. So they said, this is a great way to get people behind our National Socialist Party. And it evolved into this other thing where he became this sort of leader and then the leader. And then who knew that he had this ability to figure it out, to stay leader. But in the beginning, it was performance. It was theater. And there's no substitute for it. One of the weird things we should talk about this, because I think we both feel strongly about this, is that because our society is so saturated with film and TV right now, I think a lot of people come to the theater and treat it like they're watching live TV or live movies, and they're missing so many qualities of what makes theater really exciting. And that includes our own world of theater people who have come up out of the academy, and they treat it as if it's a script that has been, you know, the script is the first thing.
Right.
But really, what's really happening is something you can't put your finger on. And it's one of the reasons why I feel true brotherhood with Mike in terms of what we've been doing over all these years, is that I think we both understand theater is ephemeral. You either are there or you're not there. And when you're there, it's magic. And you're going to go on a ride, and that's the thing. It's not something you can watch again afterwards, even though there've been plenty of videos of both of us performing. It's never the same thing. Yeah. And yes, there's a ton of words. Both of us memorize, what, hour and a half worth of material every time you sit down. And yet, that's not really what it is. And a big part of it is the audience and their, that one, what was the one where they, what did they do? They poured a glass of water on your desk or something.
Yes, the show destroyed my notes. And
yeah, because they were so upset.
They were very upset.
There was a lot of energy going on in that house.
And they were very angry. That.
Was that ART in Boston?
Yeah, that was ART in Boston. I agree with you, especially I think that, you know, I was just reading this great essay, earlier today, talking about how film has changed in that, you know, when people were writing film criticism 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people were talking about a film was a construct of memory. Because you would see the film, but you didn't write your review while you were watching the film. So most of people's experience of video was in memory. It was like, I remember it being very moving, but the actual video is not accessible. Meanwhile, I'm sitting here with you. We both have devices with us that could summon up video in a moment. If we wanted to see a scene from a famous movie and be like, oh, our conversation would be really enlightened if we were able to have moment by moment analysis of that video, we could actually summon it to our phones and watch it right here. And so the essay, which was focused on cinema, was making the point that the way we watch film changes entirely because we no longer view it through the lens of memory. It becomes like sort of eternally present. Mm. And the person writing it, who was a film reviewer, was talking about how, like, you have to make a decision. Like, am I reviewing the film I saw? Or if I have the ability to pull up scenes, should I pull up scenes as I'm writing a piece? Because it's radically different whether you're like, what it is that surfaces on its own and what you can recall by going into Wikipedia or going into YouTube, recalling the scenes and seeing them. And I feel like this whole discussion throws into sharp contrast how far the spectrum has shifted toward the immediate availability of all information, which is why the theater remains this intensely mysterious place. Because you go into this room and things happen in the room, but there is no record of what happens in the room, because while you're in the room, you're ostensibly being quiet and watching. So all that exists actually is the memory Like, yeah. People leave that room. And all there is the memory of the thing that happened and the web work of stories that people tell between each other about what it was in that room. And I look at, like, the downtown theater scene and, like, the shows that persist in memory. It's hard to know later if those were the best shows or were those the best shows that told the best stories afterward. Because sometimes a show that persists is because people are like, did you see? Yeah. She was naked and then
she's going out of her hair and Finley. You're right. And then she poured a can of peaches on her head and it's never going to be forgotten.
Right.
Whether you even were there or not.
Right. Right. And I wonder about that. Like I think about this often when I'm, you know, think not like my work. I'm now getting into middle age. And so the fact that the work is ephemeral, is becoming sharper and keener for me. You know, the fact that we do all this work and then it vanishes and there's nothing to show for it afterwards. Like that was something very holy to me in my youth. And I think it's still holy to me now, but man, It's harsh.
Well,
it's
I've been
harsh medicine.
Yeah, and you continue to make live work, and I pretty much hung up my cleats as far as the solo stuff went 15 years ago. I just said, I'm not going to – I've done this. I did it for 20 years, and that was that. And at the time, I was kind of riding pretty high as a standard bearer of the solo piece, right? And I had been one of the first guys who had been doing these things. And so it never occurred to me that, of course, if you stop performing, I guess I should have understood this right away, that it won't take very long for no one to have any idea what you do. And so 15 years now down the road, although the monologues are used in classes and so forth, I don't think no one seems to, you know, put it together, which is fine with me. But the funny thing is every passing year means that those solo shows that I did are kind of receding, and it's, of course, major effort on my part. I did 1,000 performances of those solo things.
Yeah.
And so they were, you know, they were a big part of my life. Although, as an older guy, as a guy who's aging, I think a big part of getting old gracefully is letting go and saying that happened then and this is who I am now. And yeah, I may not be as flash as I was when I was 32, but doesn't really make any difference. My feeling about us as people is that we're all really just, we're the same person. So if somebody else now is out there jumping around doing it and kicking it, I'll go see them. And right. I feel, and that's one of the things also that happens in an audience, is the audience feels you up there and they come to life because you're coming to life. That, you know, whatever you think about Hamilton, and I happen to really love Hamilton, but Hamilton, one of the things that makes Hamilton really exciting is that it's insanely hard to get a ticket. The people mm-hmm. who are going feel very privileged that they're there. The cast is young and really, you know, it's nothing more exciting than walk out and it's a sold out show. So everybody's amped and the whole thing is just this amped experience, which is can be a really great part of what makes theater a lot of fun. But you know, what'll happen over the years, the road shows will evolve and so forth, and it'll be a different experience for audiences than to just walk in and like, wow, I'm here at like the Woodstock of theater tonight.
Right, right.
That sort of is happening currently.
No, it'll be hard to capture that lightning in a bottle, that thing that's happening now with it.
Like, because it's a kind of a hand into hand to glove kind of thing that's happening between that person on stage. And even though that's an ensemble piece, there are a lot of, you know, things where people kind of step out and do their thing. Mm-hmm. And it's whether it's Jefferson or whoever it is comes out and does a big monologue, Burr, all the energy in the room is pouring down into this person and is being reflected back into the audience. And it's this, it has nothing to do with what's happening with TV or movies. Cause yeah. That obviously can't happen in a TV or movie. I mean, one of the funny things about, I mean, I, at this point in my life, I've done probably as much TV and movies as I've done live theater. But I can't remember the difference between any of the TV and movies that I've done. It's always like some guy's got a microphone over my head and I'm trying to remember the lines and it's fragmented, and as opposed to you know, even I did this play last summer at Williamstown, and it was like to do like a little play in Williamstown, and yet I will remember exactly what happened, who I was doing it with, all the different
right
things that came together that made that experience happen. I can't say I remember all the tour dates doing the solo thing, and I bet you don't either.
No, they merged together over time, because one of the things is that I think is happening, but I remember each show really clearly, as sort of an experience, each production, I should say. And that makes sense because, of course, when you're in an ensemble, there's this time limit on the universe because there'll be the final performance and then all these people who've been making this elaborate ritual uh-huh. will go away. Whereas when you're touring with yourself, you've brought the entire ensemble with you. So in a way, the show doesn't have an end date until you yeah. finally don't do it anymore. And for me, often, I don't know when the last time I do a show is. I can feel that they're not happening as often and I'm moving on to something else, or they're in rotation, but they're not coming up as much. So I have a feeling sometimes nostalgically as I do it. I'm like, it might be the last time I do this one, but I don't actually know it. Whereas with a production,
yeah.
you know, the odds of getting all these actors together, this is not going to happen this way again.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then you have that intense.
That's absolutely true.
I think that arc is, that's the difference for.
Now I have to say that since you brought this up, that I thought that my last solo performance stuff was up in a fjord town north of Reykjavik in Iceland at a performance art festival there. The whole town came out. There were about 60 people in this little center, art center, none of whom spoke English. It was a great show. It was just fantastic. And I was pretty sure that was going to be the last one. And I was happy that that was the last one. And that was about 15 years ago. Since then, I've done a few benefits. I've kind of, you know, made my way through. And now I am doing this crazy thing, which I'm sharing with you right now. Just tell you how crazy this is that, this 100 monologues book, which counts up all the monologues I did over those 20 years. Well, anyway, we're doing one of these 100 monologues type shows at the Dallas AT&T Center, which I told you before, and in the middle of February. And crazily, I've decided that I'm going to really learn, rehearse, and nail down, as opposed to just kind of goof around, which I've done in the past, about... There aren't really 100 good ones. There's like 40 great ones that I think are pretty great. And so I'm committing 40, which means I have to do a lot of memorizing right now. Mm. And I'm going to come in and do them in rep and do basically work my way through, you know, in three different shows will be three different things. And then I'll do a fourth show, which will kind of be me goofing off and doing the nastiest, funnest pieces for myself on the late show on the Saturday night. But, I mention it because an important part of what is happening with these shows for me, and again, I feel kindred spirit with you about this, is that I'm never doing this to get to some other place. It's true, I'm going to get a check and I need the check. But the thing is that I'm also fascinated by the idea to see, can I pull it off? Can mm-hmm. I learn all these things? And can I pull off this weekend? And again, you know, some people will be there, people won't be there. It's not going to happen again. And that's that. But right. It's interesting to me. And that was the beginning of all of this. I mean, whether it was you doing what you're doing or whether I did what I did. I remember Spalding doing his first monologue show at Dance Theater Workshop. And the conceit with that little desk and everything was he was going to see if he could talk off the cuff and tell us a story, a bunch of stories that he had in mind, with some notes, the way that you do your shows, and see if he could just kind of wing it. Mm-hmm. And he did, and it was fantastic because he's really good at it, or he was really good at it. And eventually what happened was the shows hardened into what they were, and then they became like so locked down, like Swimming to Cambodia, they became like these literary pieces. But the original thing was a process thing for him that had to do with making theater. Yeah. And he would put himself in these positions that were very difficult. And I remember because we used to go into punk clubs in the late 70s, and he would do the weirdest stuff, like just get in front of the audience and say to the audience in a punk club, mind you. So they're not the nicest people. And he'd just say, tell me to do anything and I'll do it and we'll do it. You know, I'll do anything and you say it and I'll do that, or I'll improv of it. It was almost like an extension of what Second City would do with the improvs. But he was taking it because he wanted to see how hard he could make it and whether he could get there or not. It was like some kind of theater gymnastics. And, but it's so hard to do these memory shows, these shows that are very dense in language, which I'm talking about both of our shows, that the audience, I think, gets a sense that we're on a ride and we don't really know if this guy's going to make it or not. He may just fall right off the, off the bicycle halfway through the show because it's hard to do. Now, you and I both, I know, learned over the years techniques that were particular to the shows we do. Mm-hmm. So when I first started doing them, I wasn't sure, but eventually I knew like some tricks, and there's a whole bunch of tricks. I don't know whether you do them or not, but I would, you know, you'd be in some weird theater center in Minneapolis or something, and there'd be leaking water from, or somebody would cough or something would happen that was live, and it was it created like a mistake in the show. And then you'd work off of that. So then eventually you go, you know what? I'm going to put that mistake in every night. And you put the mistake in every night, and audiences just love this. I can't tell you how many people, oh, I saw the show where you dropped the script and then you had to pick it up and you couldn't figure it. It was like, well, that was basically every show I've done that. But I'm glad you think it was, you know, but these are all like little theater trick things that you learn over the time.
They do love that. They love that. I mean, the audience.
The suckers.
People. No, yes. They love it. They love I mean, it's probably one of the reasons why I've always been, you know, I did a whole series about P.T. Barnum. I'm just like really fascinated by like the exchange, you know, the thing, you know, people want to be subverted and delighted.
Yeah.
People want that. Even if they claim that they don't want it, they do want to be subverted and delighted. It's funny you talking about, the form and pushing the boundaries reminds me of, you know, in the last 5 years, you know, after I finally felt like I had got, there was this expansion thing that went on with me where I was like, okay, I made the monologues work and they're about 90 minutes long. And then I was like, I made the monologue work. It's about 105 minutes long. Now I made a monologue work. It's 2 hours long. And, you know, audiences and friends were like, Mike, they're getting a little long. Like, it's really going. I mean, I get that there are three braided narratives and all the things. And it's all very, but like seriously, my ass, like it's getting kind of long. And so instead of having a rational response where I'd be like, okay, well, I'll just do 1.5 threads and they'll give me twice the material. And then I can probably take naps more often. Instead, I was like, no, I need to do a 24-hour show. And then I just started like trying to find things that like broke the boundaries. Because suddenly it seemed really small. I remember it suddenly the whole world of the stage. This has happened a couple times in my life, in my career, where it's like you fill up a container and then you start to get this sort of ennui. And I'm just like, well, that's what there is. A monologue can only do so much. It's only like blah, blah, blah. And I wallow in that for a little while. And then you crack the edge of the egg or the jar, whatever your metaphor you like is, and suddenly you realize that jar was sitting inside a much larger jar, and suddenly there's so much more to do. Like I did this show a couple of years ago where every night I made a new chapter, and basically I performed a novel. It was like 29 nights. I did 29 full-length shows. Faces of the Moon, and it was 29. It was a full novel. Like the whole thing together is like one giant work. And, you know, after I built that, I actually really was like, oh, like really, like I actually had the reverse thing, because now that I satisfied myself that it is possible to be on stage and you have the same size and scale as a novel, suddenly I was more attracted to the short story again. I was suddenly like, oh, well, now that I've proven to myself that I can get this extreme, I'm suddenly much more interested in what is a 40-minute show like? What is, like, I finally was ready to not be trapped at 2 hours. It was funny. Like, I'm reminded hearing about Spalding, like, that urge to just, like, figure out where the edges are of the thing and break it. It's a really strong... I have that a lot. that sort of has shaped a lot of the decisions I've made, for good and for bad, I'm sure.
I think that talking about Spalding, talking about what you do, talking about the monologue stuff that I did, there was a lot, there are a lot of underpinnings that have to do with theatricality that came from our training in the theater, our understanding of what makes theater. But at the end of the day, an audience walks in, they see one person standing up there or sitting up there, or a woman in the case of like Dale Orlander Smith, and this person is up there and they go, oh, I can do that. You know, you get out and you just start talking. And as a result, I'm sorry to say, because I say this all the time, I hate solo shows, because there's like, for every one that I want to go see, there are 100 that are somebody just getting up there and telling you some things and talking about their life, how they feel about stuff. I mean, that was where Spalding was such a great artist, because he wasn't, it sounded like he was talking about how he just felt about things, but he was thinking about a theme and he was trying to interconnect it all into something, and it became a piece. Now, one of the things about this is that, aside from like me putting down people who do solo shows for reasons that I don't think are really good reasons, like it's a showcase or it's going to get me into the movies or the TV or whatever it is. That which believe me, that existed, always existed. And that was why people didn't like solo shows.
That's where that great expression from Variety, a vehicle.
A vehicle.
Like, I never want to see a show of any kind that's a vehicle. Like, I just want to be in an experience with you.
Yeah.
In the audience with the person on stage. I do not want to be in a vehicle, but I think, driven off somewhere.
Well, one of the things I think that's a little puzzling to people is you could put a lot of work into this to get to this place that gets to the show, that gets to that hour and a half that somebody goes to the public or whatever and sees it, and they walk out and, news for you. I didn't make $1 million for doing this. I got $100 for doing it. And I'm not going to get famous for doing it. And I'm not going to, you know, there's no that other part. Yeah. There's just that night and that thing, which I personally happen to love and think is magic. Part of the impulse for me to do 100monologues.com was to find some way to kind of, I don't know, make those monologues kind of permanent. Mm-hmm. But there was, again, for me, the visceral aspect of just pure enjoyment, because I happen to love all my actor friends and I can't get enough of them. And I thought, you know, for better, for worse, I get to see a lot of Mike Daisy or Lisa Joyce or Jessica Hecht or Bobby Cannavale or whoever it is Matt Mayer is going to come in and do one of these things. And that was that. You got to be sure, you want to really preserve that fun part of it. I understand that we have careers and things and we have to move our little chess piece forward or whatever on some kind of board. Although I personally, whenever I have attempted to do that, it doesn't work. And it's always in the most unexpected ways that some kind of thing works out. I just don't see it coming. So I think you should just kind of go from impulse and have fun and enjoy yourself and let the community carry you if they like what you're
doing.
Well,
I mean, one of the joys of working in the theater is that it's one of the few forms that still is mostly hyper-local. Like, a show only exists where you're doing it. So, you know, like these sort of things that have become a huge part of these movements of our time, where it's like this YouTube video has been watched by 100 million people or whatever, whatever's happening. Those things can't really be part of the theater. And so, the side effect of that is that it's always a very small pool. I mean, it always is, wherever you are. Like, we're here in New York. It's a very small pool here in New York. Like, and the other pools are even smaller. And so, if you're not actually having fun, you know, if you're very careerist and you're not, but you're not having fun, it's like, there's no money. There's no, mm-hmm. Nothing's going to happen. This doesn't lead anywhere. So if you haven't had fun doing it, it's a terrible waste.
Do get launched from their, I mean, into some degree, theater can be like a bullpen for the major leagues, the big game that's out in LA or here, TV. And, you know, who am I? That's happened for me. So, you know,
but it's a funny bullpen, because like you make that jump and then that world has very little to do with the world you came from, you know, like, especially in terms of fun. I mean, I'm grappling with that right now. I have all these, friends, colleagues, people I'm really intimate with who've made the jump to like writing a lot for TV and are sort of like living that path. And it does not make me yearn to write for television, to put it that way.
No,
like,
it's not
like hearing about it and experiencing it. Everyone likes money. I would not mind if people brought me boxes of money. I think everyone feels that way. Money is nice. But other than the money showing up, I think that it's very hard. You know, like the movie industry, the film and TV industry is so heavily corporatized. And then this thing that we're doing here is so not. Like, there's actually a human and they actually decided what they felt like doing. And in a way, that's one of the things I like about the solo form is the extreme freedom of it, you know? It's even free, for the most part, of the strictures we put on theater, where we're like, well, we're going to rehearse for 3 weeks, and here are your people, and this is a script. Even those things often are dissolved. They're just one person. So you can see the most idiosyncratic things because one person was entirely responsible for what was made, which I will offer as like a, just as a, I totally get the thing where solo performance is hard to watch. I've done my time. I have the scars from watching some terrible solo shows. I get that. At the same time, I really do feel like if solo performance in 100 years or 200 years had the same kind of backing that theater has built around it, it would, I think the average quality of a solo show would be much higher. You know, the people who come into it each time are like breaking out of one of those eggs or those jars in that metaphor. They're breaking out. They're like, oh my God, what is this world? And then many of them are making, you know, atrocious mistakes. And then I often see, being old enough now, people make the same mistakes again and again and again, in large part because, you know, there's no schooling. There's no place where people are like, you know, there's no school of criticism. Nothing is out yet coalesced. That's like, this is what we consider a good solo show, you know? Like, I feel like most critics are still in the same place that you are, and that maybe I am to some extent, where they're like, I dreaded going to see this show, for there was only one person in it. But then I was delighted, you know? Like, often they say that beginning when they're allowed to be nice about it later. And the problem with that framing is, it's a fine, but it's sort of an infantile framing. Like, honestly, over time, like, if solo performance got the kind of attention that, that theater gets, I think that we wouldn't be in that situation. I think that things would.
Well, I don't know what I think about what you're saying there, because I'm not going to disagree.
You can disagree.
I'm not disagreeing. But I think about some of the solo performers who had the biggest effect on me, and what a strange place they came from, particularly Brother Theodore, who truly came out of a left field you couldn't even imagine, a survivor of the Holocaust who ends up in San Francisco around the beat scene in the 1950s and starts doing this show where he comes out in the guise of the brother, as in like a kind of a preacher guy who's going to give a sermon every night on the most ludicrous and insane things, where he gets himself into a complete tizzy and is basically chewing out the audience and yelling at them. And this whole piece that he did was really grounded in Weimar aesthetic of the, you know, the kind of things that were happening around the, you know, the cabaret scene when he was a young man, and the surrealist poetry scene and so forth. I knew him up until just before his, he passed away in his 90s, and he was so funny. I mean, he was like, you know, Eric, I 91, you know, I'd give anything to have the sex drive I had when I was 82, you know? he was just always funny. Anyway, so as we're winding down, what would be your advice then to the young, up and coming University of Michigan solo performance artist who needs some advice?
Well, I mean,
where do you go? How do you get started? What do you do?
What you cheat.
Cheat.
You cheat. You cheat and you lie and you break the system. The system as it's designed is designed to, is a giant set of gears to grind people up into hamburger. Well, the system as it's designed is designed to destroy people. And this goes for traditional actors right alongside solo performers, or whatever it is you, like if you want to enter the theater, the entire system is designed to destroy people. My advice is always, like, you're going to have to cheat. Like, you have to figure out what your advantages are, and then exploit them mercilessly. You know, like, figure out what you cannot live without. Like, think about, you know, Brother Theodore, I've loved listening to recordings of him, and like, the truth is that he found the bizarre, idiosyncratic person that's inside of him.
Yeah.
And he embraced that. And that's one of the reasons why those recordings exist for me to listen to.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, embrace it. You have to like resign yourself, I think, as a young person to the reality that like you can do everything correctly. You can break the system, subvert everything, and you still may die. In fact, you definitely will die eventually, but you may die unfulfilled. You like may
on stage,
yeah,
in front of an audience.
Yes, in front of an audience,
which is
like painful. Like you may never get to the places that you're expecting to get to. None of these things may happen for you.
Yeah.
That's why I think that like I think the things that keep people coming back, and like I, as a young person, had grown up in this poor rural place, and honestly, like I didn't think my life was worth that much, and so I was sort of like, well, I could continue doing this in this place that is terrible, or I could risk everything so I could be on stage. And, you know, when you don't have that much, risking everything seems like a pretty good bet. And then I often find as I get older, that's the trick to remaining limber is being able to roll the dice again. It'll be like, what would it be to be on stage and actually maybe be on the edge of not knowing how to actually handle all the parts? What would actually be the largest thing I could do?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that would be my advice for young people. You know, like you have to risk. You have to risk everything. And then, and risk really means risk. Not like you risk everything and then you know it'll turn out well. That's not risk.
See, for me, it went completely the other way. I was completely cowed and frightened by the New York theater scene when I first got here. And I ran away and I hid in this visual arts community down in Soho, which didn't even exist at the time, answering the phones at a performance art place, The Kitchen. And eventually I sort of came out of my shell and I started doing these little tiny performances. But the people who were coming to these little tiny theaters were not theater people. They were visual arts people. Mm. And they would come and I would just think like, what makes them laugh? All my friends. And so it became a community created aesthetic based on what, you know, what does Cindy Sherman think is funny as opposed to what do theater people think is properly funny or the right, you're not doing the accent right. And these visual arts guys didn't know anything about anything. So it grew organically out of that, but basically from a very timid place on my part. And I got more and more emboldened by being embraced by this very small community, and then they liked what I liked, and then it just fell out, and Joe Papp wandered into my life, and it made it all work. I get the feeling we should be winding down.
Okay.
But how do we wind down? We don't know how to. We know how to do something. There's always a way to end the show.
This is like the end of Waiting for Godot or something. Like the universe is disassembling itself, and we've forgotten how to end. We're not really sure where to go.
Well, what's your show? What's your next show?
I'm working on. I'm working on two projects. One is very smaller in scale and topical, which is I'm working on a show about Trump. And it's about Donald Trump. It's about Trump's history. It's about his evolution, and it's about the rise of conservatism. And it's specifically about how conservatism allied itself with business interests starting in the 30s and the whole path that leads us to a place where someone like Trump can hijack the process. So that's one thing I'm working on. And then the other thing I'm working on is a stage adaptation of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States.
Nice.
Which is like me performing each chapter as its own piece. And the chapter is performed as though it's like a teaching text. So it's like I'm teaching the history. So it's like I go over the history, but you're assumed to have done some reading. And then I'm like giving the history, but making it funny or grim by turns. And then also comparing it, I went and found the books that I had as my history books when I was in like junior high and high school. And I'm comparing that history with the history that Zinn has and sort of talking about why official histories look the way they do.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep working. I know you can't wait to hear what I'm doing next, but I'm going to keep shooting the 100monologues.com. We've now posted 50 videos and we're doing a Kickstarter right now. And so, we've raised most of the money already. So that's great. And so we're going to get back in March and start shooting more of them until we finish them and have all 50, all 100 posted. And then I don't know, I guess I'll just retire to a Zen garden in somewhere in, you know, Kyoto.
Oh, I hope so.
Just rake the sand all day.
Evanesce into the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not bad.
Yeah.
And we're back. That was fun. We have some recommendations, endorsements, whatever you want to call them. Deep, why don't you start out?
Okay. To riff off of the television themed, I'm going to recommend a TV show on the CW called Jane the Virgin. And apparently, according to Susie, they have a playwright on their writing team, a Christopher Oscar Pena. Which, Pena?
Oscar
Pena.
Oscar, yeah. Christopher Oscar Pena.
Yeah, that's what I said.
You said Oscar.
Oscar. Okay. I don't like R's. R's are difficult.
It's okay.
If you loved like stylized shows such as Ugly Betty and telenovelas, then you will love Jane the Virgin because the concept is ridiculous and I wasn't into it in the beginning and now I love it.
It's amazing.
It stars Golden Globe winner Gina Rodriguez, who is artificially inseminated. She's a virgin and she's artificially inseminated and becomes pregnant.
Accidentally artificially inseminated.
Yeah. You know, stuff happens sometimes when you're at the OBGYN. And it's about the fallout of that unplanned pregnancy because she's a bit of a control freak. And then there's also the side plot about how there's a serial killer killer going around in the hotel that her baby daddy, who she meets after she is artificially inseminated by his sperm, there's a serial killer slash drug lord going around.
But she knew her baby daddy from before because they kissed in the pool like 10 years earlier.
Yeah, but it was like a one-time kiss though.
But they knew each other.
So it's worth watching.
Yes, it's very stylized and dramatic in terms of storyline, but the acting is very naturalistic. And so it helps ground you. Mm. Otherwise, it would just be like flights of ridiculousness. And the actors are amazing. It's a mostly Latino cast, Hispanic Latino. And one of the characters, Jane's grandmother, Jane, the character played by Gina, she speaks entirely in Spanish. And the thing about the ethnicity in the TV show is they never make a big point of saying, oh, look at this Hispanic Latino person and look how great they're doing at life despite the stereotypes and, you know, hardship. Mm-hmm. This is our family and these are the circumstances that happen within this particular family. It's very specific to this family, but at the same time, they're just, you know, human, relatable, funny, wonderful people. And it's just a great cast of actors.
It's very believable. I mean, it's wild circumstances, but you trust that this would happen. And it's very good.
Well, I mean, it's not going to happen in real life, but you believe that it's happening. And
crazier things have happened.
Right. I have not seen the show. I've heard it's really good. It reminds me of a The premise reminds me of a famous like old wives' tale. I think Tom Waits retold this one time. I don't know if you've heard this one about the Civil War woman who was impregnated when a bullet.
What? What?
She's impregnated.
You can't get impregnated by a bullet, Rob.
No, this was
gun control.
It was fired through. It went through a man's scrotum and then entered her stomach, and that somehow she was impregnated. This is like one of those an urban legend, but not urban.
It actually happened.
No, I don't think it actually happened, but it's one of those sort of old wives' tales, like conceiving how someone could get pregnant without sex, and that a bullet did this. It's an old story that has no basis in fact, but I think Tom Waits' kicker was like, it's a good story if you like action.
Anyway. Well, if this had actually happened to Jane, she would have actually gotten pregnant.
Yeah, because
she's supposed to get a pap smear, and she accidentally gets artificially inseminated.
It could happen.
So be careful the next time you go to the OBGYN.
Gina Rodriguez gets a shout out in our February issue. Lou Diamond Phillips is our Q&A in the back. He has a play in a small theater in Vermont, I think.
Yeah.
I should double check that.
Yeah, we should.
And he mentions he likes Gina's work a lot on the show.
No, the play's actually at Seven Angels Theater in Waterbury, Connecticut. It's called Burning Desire.
All right. Connecticut, Vermont, somewhere New England-y. And also in our February issue is my interview with Eric Bentley. And, I don't think I've recommended this on the, podcast before, but his books are still in print and they are a great read. His famous books, Playwright is Thinker. There's also one called What is Theater? And In Search of Theater. There's also an anthology of his writings on Brecht. And I just ordered one that was not in print called Theater of War, which is his piece, one of his last books of criticism from the late 60s and 70s. I can't vouch for. He has a great essay on Mother Courage, which I wish I had read before the recent controversy and entered it into the discussion because he said a lot of things that were really relevant to the debate. His writing is always it blew my mind when I was younger, the connections he was making between, among authors in the Western tradition and elsewhere. And also, he's not confined to English language playwrights. He reads French, German. I don't know if he reads Norwegian, but he's able to trace the lines, particularly after 19th century theater, of what realism means. I mean, one of his big themes is that realism doesn't mean the same thing to every playwright. Brecht called himself a realist. Anyway, I highly recommend checking in if you haven't already with Eric Bentley's writings or rereading it. It's always a pleasure. That's my recommendation. Susie?
I haven't seen anything recently that I have really liked that I would recommend, but I am going down to DC to Arena Stage to see Sweat next weekend. I think Rob has recommended it on the podcast.
That's a good show. That's a good play.
And I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very, very excited. And so I'm going to preemptively recommend it and say I'm really excited.
It's the same cast as in Oregon.
It's not the same cast?
Oregon. The Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I think it is the same cast.
Okay.
Honestly, yeah.
You saw it there, right?
I did. I did not. I think Charles's review was one of the most – Charles Isherwood's review in the Times is – one of the best reviews he's ever given to anything. And I don't think it's that good, I think it actually might become that good. I mean, she was still working on it. So,
well, I hate to admit this. I've actually never seen a play by Lynn Nottage. So I'm really excited to see it. I hear it's amazing.
She's all right.
She's all right. She knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's open. It's like started performances at Arena in DC. So check it out.
Nice. I think that ends another fine edition of Offscript. I'll just say, please go to iTunes, rate us, review us, recommend us to friends, go on our Facebook page. It helps people find us. Look for links to these stories we talked about and many others on our website. Thanks for listening.